So, hello and welcome for computer graphics. And since this is the second lesson, I will have to start with organizational things again. So, one little thing that we messed up is that we forgot that we would also be interested in how many students would like to get only the tutorials, but not the programming tutorials. And some of you, I think, also sent emails, because with the EST, it's a bit confusing. You have to check one tutorial, one programming tutorial, but you cannot check the other oral tutorial, and so on. okay, and that was confusing from our side. So please, I would like to ask you, please go back to EST. If in case you haven't done yet since yesterday or so, and check again that you apply is not check in for the normal tutorials and for the programming tutorials. I mean, if you have done so already, it's not cleared, yeah. And it's not lost, and it's not a problem if you fail to do so, and there are two or three more. It's just that we know how many people there will come and how many tutorials we will need. Okay, so that was a mistake from our side, or yeah? I think the course is CG, and the password is CG 2013. Is that right? Okay. Good. So that's number one. Then number two, as always, somebody asked whether it would be possible to move the lecture a bit. And as you maybe remember, we decided last time, I think, that the lecture on Tuesdays will be from 12:30 to 14, is that right? And on Thursdays, we said 13:15 to 14. And now somebody said there's a conflict with the lecture for that slot and whether we can move it to the first hour of that slot. So we have decided to take that one, yeah? So if anybody prefers the second one and says, no, I don't want this to be moved, or it cannot be moved because of other lectures, then we will stick to that time. So is there anybody who would have a conflict if we move that one to whatever, 12:30 to 13:15 or something like that? None. Yeah?
Yeah, I would have a conflict.
Okay.
I have another lecture at 40. So it could be until 40:15.
So, no, okay. So your lecture is at 2 p.m.?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we move it forward, then you don't have a conflict, right?
Forward would be okay.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's... So the new proposal would be, I would say... 12:30 maybe, so there's time for lunch, is that okay?
Yeah.
12:30 to 13:15? I mean, it's a bit of a weird time, but... Should we try that? No problems? Wow. Our time planning works. Okay, so... So the good news is that the lecture is over now. Okay, good. I will try to communicate that on the webpage, yeah? 12, so we always start at 12:30. So that's quite easy to remember then. And we all will have a full stomach for the lecture. Okay. Yeah? Yes, I know that, and it's, okay. Yeah, so we will tell you the password as soon as possible. But it's no problem. So it starts next week only. Yeah. So the first assignments are due by the end of October. So you have plenty of time, and you will learn that soon. And I will also add a password for the slides. So the slides should be available for you, at least the first two ones. But the other ones, then we will also add a password for that. And that will be the same for all of these, and we will tell you. I will tell you latest on Tuesday in the lecture, okay? Excellent. Okay, so we have the solution. So user, that makes sense. User and password. Okay. And there was one more thing. I just wanted to mention that next Saturday there will be the Lange Nacht der Wissenschaften. Maybe you saw. It's difficult not to see the signs everywhere and so on. And we will also have a show from our chair of computer graphics in the lecture hall H11. And we will show, I think, nice work from our group. So of course we would be happy to not only have old fathers working for Siemens visiting us, but also young students looking at our show. Okay. Good. So, are there any further organizational things? Excellent. Okay. So, the purpose of today's lecture is to give you a brief overview of what we call the graphics pipeline. The rendering process, which will be the main topic of this lecture, is typically described by a pipeline. So different steps that have to be performed one after the other to transform a 3D world description, 3D world model in the computer to an image. And in this lecture, we will go through these different steps of the pipeline, one after the other. And it's difficult to explain and to understand a single part of the pipeline if you don't know how the entire pipeline looks like. So what we will do today is that I give you a brief introduction how this graphics pipeline looks so that you understand the different steps and that you have an idea if we then focus or dive into one of these stages of the pipeline, that you know the context and why certain things happen at that particular step. So the purpose of today is just to give you an overview of the pipeline. It's kind of introduction to what will follow then. So the rendering pipeline always starts with a description of the 3D world, of a 3D world that we want to look at. So an example that you will see quite often is this bunny model here. You see how, or it's the triangles that are used to model that bunny are explicitly shown here, just to show what you probably all know very well already, that objects in computer graphics are typically described by a set of triangles. So the surface of the object is described. The surface is described by a triangle mesh or by such a set of triangles here. And this describes the surface of our objects. That's a typical representation. Yeah, I will go into a bit into detail for that one because that part we will always need. Okay. So this is not the only thing. Typically, our scenes need more. We do not only have geometry. We also have to describe how the surfaces, for instance, reflect light. And we also need descriptions about light sources in the scene. And if we have all that, we can generate images. In the next step, what we have to do is that we have to transform this 3D world into our image. Yeah, we have to project that scene into our image. This gives us perspective. So in that example, we see a cube, and we see that typical perspective view of a cube. We will also detail that. I already mentioned it. There's very, very elegant ways to describe all this. And it's a very interesting mapping. And we will learn quite a bit about this projection here. Now imagine we have as input this bunny with all these triangles. They live in 3D space. Then they are projected into our image. And what we have now in image space is lots of triangles, possibly millions of these. But we just have the coordinates of the corner points of these triangles. Yeah? So we have 3 points in our image, and we know they span a triangle. And we now have to somehow convert this into a raster representation. So we have to find which pixels are touched by this triangle. Yeah? Or more precisely, in how this is done here, so for which of these pixels is the midpoint within the triangle? So this process is called rasterization. It's a very, very challenging task in the sense that, as I said, we have millions of triangles, and we want to rasterize these millions of triangles typically in a reasonable time, maybe even in real time. So it's very important that we have a fast way to do that and to understand that process, how rasterization works. Okay, now we transformed all this into pixels. Yeah, and in the next step, or there's one step which is very close related with rasterization, is visibility. Of course, all these triangles or several of these triangles can overlap in image space. There can be one object in front of another, or even within an object. Yeah? One ear of the bunny can occlude another part, or maybe the other ear. So we somehow have to resolve this visibility. This is another topic, how this can be done easily. And in the end, for all of these pixels, we have to find colors. And what is typically done here is that simulation is maybe too strong. A heuristic is used to compute for a given point and given light sources how much light from this light source is reflected at that point towards the eye. And this gives us a shading on the object. As you can see here, yeah, this little statue, it has a constant material. So the color of that object is constant. Yeah, but due to illumination from a light source, you can see the structure on the object. Yeah, you can see, orientation of the surface and so on, because it's all reddish, but depending on the position relative to the light, the color of the object becomes brighter or darker or whatever. Yeah? This process we call lighting, and in fact, this is the last part of our pipeline. Okay, so a little more in detail. In particular, I will say a bit more about this description of the objects, because that's the very basic part. We will always have to start with such objects and such descriptions. So there are several examples of objects that we can want to describe. And of course, as I said, you do not always have to use triangles. There are certain simple objects which are much easier to describe in another way, like a cube, for instance, or a cylinder, or I think it's an icosahedron. So regular objects are quite easy to describe, but the downside of using such simple objects is, of course, it's very difficult to construct whatever, an animal or a face, only using cubes and cylinders and icosahedra and all these regular things. And furthermore, if you think about rasterization, Yeah, if you have such many different simple objects, you need to write a rasterizer for a cube, which is probably not very difficult, but you need to write it. And you need to write a rasterizer for cylinders and for cones, maybe, and for icosahedra, and so on. And that's, yeah, just doesn't make sense. So what we assume for now is that all our objects are represented by triangle meshes. Yeah, and all these objects that you saw before can be represented by triangle meshes. For the cylinder, of course, it will always only be an approximation. But by just using small triangles, it's still okay. And any other complex geometry can be represented using such triangles. I always say triangles, but in fact, we should say polygons, because there are also representations that don't use triangles, but maybe quads, quadrilaterals. They are the basic primitive that we will use all the time. Every surface, yeah, can be approximated using polygons. We will learn how we can render polygons quickly, how we can rasterize them, how we can compute all this stuff here for polygons. So it's really the basic primitive. And memory and disk space is cheap. So what that means is that, of course, it would be simpler to describe a sphere by its center and a radius, for instance, instead of using thousands of triangles for its surface. The unification is definitely worth it, even if it requires much more memory and disk space. Okay, so how are such polygons defined? I mean, it's pretty obvious. A polygon is defined by a list of vertices that describe its boundary. We typically assume that all these points lie on a plane, or at least almost on a plane. Of course, otherwise you could generate very weird geometry that wouldn't work with a rasterizer or something like that. Yeah, so we assume we have points on a plane and they define a polygon. And there are certain restrictions. We will also hear that later on or in later lectures. So for instance, the polygon should not self-intersect or have stuff like that. Yeah, but that's pretty obvious. And as polygons, we typically use triangles. And if we take together many of these triangles, we call this a triangle mesh. And if we have several or many quadrilaterals forming our object, then we are speaking, or we say that we have a quad mesh. Both are commonly used. The triangle mesh is the probably more general one and more often used. So I will now always speak of triangles, usually, in particular because any quad mesh very easily can be transformed to a triangle mesh. Yeah? Just by bisecting every quad, you get two triangles. So let's assume we have a triangle mesh like this bunny that you saw in the very beginning. So we have a number of triangles in 3D space. And these triangles are usually connected, so they form a surface. That means they two neighboring triangles, for instance, share one edge. Yeah? And what that also means is that certain vertices here are typically used by several triangles. Yeah? So this vertex here is used by for five triangles. So we have to differentiate two things. The first thing is that our model is described by these vertices. And these vertices are described by their position in 3D space. And that's what we call the geometry, yeah, because it has geometric attribute, the position in 3D space. Yeah, so our mesh first consists of these vertices. And then we also have to say how these vertices are connected to triangles. That's what we call topology. Yeah. So now that we have these vertices, we can simply enumerate them. Yeah, and now we say triangle or vertices 0, 1, and 3 form a triangle. Yeah, and okay, I forgot this one, so that's 8. So 0, 1, and 8 form another triangle. Yeah, so the connection, how these vertices are connected to triangles, this is what we call topology. So we have to differentiate these two. And looking at this example, for instance, the two meshes on the left, if you look a bit closer to them, you see that you can transform the left one to the right one just by moving vertices and leaving the connections unchanged. So that means the two meshes on the left have the same topology, yeah, but the geometry is different. The position of the vertices is different. Whereas the mesh on the right has the same geometry as the mesh in the middle, but the topology is different. Yeah, so only the positions of the vertices do not tell you how your surface looks like. Yeah, you still have to say how they are connected. And the two on the right, they have the same geometry but different topology. And of course, it also works the other way around. The two on the right have the same geometry, but the one in the middle has not the same geometry as the left one. Okay, so how can we describe such triangle meshes? So the most simple way, and also definitely not the best one, is to use a data structure that looks like this. So we describe vertices simply by their 3D coordinates. Yeah? So a vertex is described by its three x, y, and z coordinates. And a triangle is just then an array of three vertices. So what we do not do in this representation is something like I said here. So this triangle is described by the 3D coordinate of this vertex, and of this vertex. And this triangle is described by the coordinate of this vertex, and this vertex. So this coordinate here will be stored twice. It will once be stored with this triangle and once with this triangle. And also, if we take the entire mesh for this one, and for this one. This is very wasteful. And what is another problem is that there's no easy way to find out for two triangles whether they are neighboring, for instance. Yeah? Because to do so, you would have to compare vertex coordinates, 3D coordinates. And these are float values. And you know that you shouldn't do a direct comparison on float values, not an equal comparison on float values. Yeah? You never know whether they are really exactly the same or just with some epsilon and so on. Okay, so this kind of representation is called a polygon soup because, yeah, you have lots of triangles and they are not connected, yeah, like swimming in a soup and you don't know how they belong together. So the typical way to represent such a mesh that we will also use in most time in or always for the programming exercises, the so-called shared vertex representation. And here the idea is that we have two lists. We have the vertex list storing the coordinates of the vertices. So this is the geometry information. And then we have a second list, the face list, and that tells us how these vertices are connected to triangles. So oh, I forgot my presenter, but and I have no mouse. Ah, here. So for this example, a pyramid here, we have five vertices. So these are the coordinates. I mean, they're not explicitly written down here. And then we have a face list. So the first face, or face in this case means triangle, is vertices 0, 1, and 4. 0, 1, and 4, so that's this face here. And 1, 2, 4 is this face, 1, 2, 4, and so forth. And the base here is 3, 2, 1, 0. So you see here we really have a polygonal mesh because the last face is a quadrilateral, it's even a square, and the others are triangles. So that's the shared vertex data structure. I mean, it's very simple to understand. And we will use that all over the place. The good thing is it's very efficient in memory, or quite efficient, so it's not by far not as wasteful as these polygon soups. It also, in terms of performance, is just fine for our purposes. And we will see that later in a later lecture, it also has its problems. If you want to do some processing on the meshes, yeah, or any other computations on the meshes, and now let's say, for instance, you have this triangle, and you want to find out what are my neighbors, yeah, what are the neighboring triangles, yeah, then this data structure is really not very good, because essentially, to find out what is my neighbor over this edge for 7, you have to go through all the list of triangles and have to look whether another triangle also uses edges vertices 4 and 7. You don't even know where in the other triangle they appear. Yeah? So this triangle can be described as 6, 4, 7, or as 6, 7, 4, or as 4, 6, 7, or as 4, 7, 6, and so forth. Yeah. So you don't even know where you have to look for the 4, and that's not very nice to program something, and it's very slow. So if you want to, or if you need more of these queries, we will see other data structures that allow to do this very, very elegantly. But nevertheless, for our purpose, shared vertex is just fine. Another word for it is indexed face set. But it's exactly the same. Yeah, it's just another word for it. It's very widely used. Most file formats that you find that contain 3D geometry use this representation. Easy to use. And yeah, two lists, we mentioned that often enough. So here, this is an example. Oh, I forgot which file format, maybe DXF or something like that. And you see, It's really very, very basic. So the first lines are all vertices. It's 3D coordinates. So this mesh has 10, if I count correctly, 10 vertices. And then come the triangles. And the first column is always the number of vertices of the face. And then, in this case, it's all threes. So that means the entire mesh consists of triangles, and then the first triangle has vertices 0, 4, and 3, so the first triangle has this vertex, 4 is this one, and 3 is this one. Yeah? Very, very simple. So here we see again these points. Now, in a sort of 3D image, just the vertices. And if we add the triangle information, we get this here, and you see that altogether this is a very simple shape of a house. Okay, and as I said before, navigation is difficult, so finding neighborhoods in this data structure is complicated. We will learn much more sophisticated data structures. One very simple extension, just to be complete here, is to have a so-called enhanced face list. And what that means is that we do per triangle, we do not only store the vertices that form the corners of the triangle, but we also store indices to the neighbor. So that means triangle 4 is the neighbor of triangle 2, or triangle 2 has as neighbor triangle 4 and its opposite to corner 1. So let's see whether this is correct. Triangle 2, where is it? Here. Has neighbor 4 here and its opposite to vertex 1. That's correct, yeah? So vertex 1 and on the opposite side of vertex 1 there's triangle 4. So, yeah, with this kind of representation, it's quite simple to find neighbors over certain edges and so on, and to do computations on that. But there are more sophisticated ways to do that. Okay, but that's not important for now. Good. So, if you want to generate models that you want to render, one way is to open any text editor, yeah, and to type this in. So this might work for a cube and for very simple things, but not for anything complex. So typically what you want to do is download any meshes that are available on the web from somewhere, and yeah, just read them in and use them. And there are many file formats to do that. And these file formats didn't change over the last 20 or 30 years very often. So it's all very, yeah, old file formats are still widely used. One very common file format is called Open Inventor. This is really very old. It's Open Inventor was a toolkit for 3D rendering, and it also with it came a file format which is rather easy to parse, and which also was the fundament for a language called VRML, Virtual Reality Modeling Language. For some time, there were browsers around, web browsers or plugins for web browsers, so that such VRML files could be viewed. But I think they are no longer supported. But the file format is still around. And yeah. It's one of these, I'm not sure, maybe we will use it in one exercise, but I don't think so. X3D is the successor of VRML. So this is this what I just said, yeah, this Open Inventor file format, and this has been extended and so on, and it's called now X3D, and it's a real ISO standard, and it's XML-based. So that's a rather new way. One that is used very often in practice is OBJ. That has been developed by a company for their renderer, and the nice thing is that it's really quite easy to parse. And I think in one assignment you will have to write a little parser for OBJ files, and it's pure ASCII, so you can immediately look at it and see how it is structured. It's very simple. Okay, so much about the objects we will work with, yeah? So imagine your input is such a triangle mesh with vertices and information how these are connected to triangles. And then in the next step, and in fact this now is the first step of our rendering pipeline, we project this mesh into 2D. And we will spend some time with that process, and we will see how we can imagine that such a virtual camera works, yeah? How I can compute for a camera at a certain point in our 3D world, looking in a certain direction, having a certain opening angle of the lens, how we can compute where a certain point in 3D space ends up in our image. Yeah? And if you think about that, it's a quite simple process. A very simple way to see that is imagine you take a screen, yeah, and just put it in front of you, and now somebody else takes a pen or something, and paints little dots on the screen, always in the color that you exactly see through that particular point, yeah. So through that point here, I see this this paper here in the background, that yellow one, so I would make that one yellow, and that one I would make blue, and so forth. And if I'm done, I can take that screen away, and I still see exactly the same. Yeah, that's my way how I can interpret this. So essentially, we just have to generate lines from the eye to the 3D object and see where this intersects my screen. And this is a process that is quite simple to describe. We will spend some time on that. And with this, we automatically get a perspective view. So we automatically get this effect that the further things are away, the smaller they are. And we also get these typical vanishing points, yeah, that a cube, okay, that's not a cube, looks like this, yeah, where there are vanishing points, where they come together and stuff like that. And we will, of course, to be able to implement it on the computer, we will see how we can do this mapping from 3D to 2D. And in fact, it's not really a mapping to 2D because it's not only sufficient to know where on the image a point is, we also need to know how far it's away from the camera to compute visibility or to compute occlusion. So in fact, we transform from 3D to 3D, just the depth. We also have to keep the depth in the image to be able to compute occlusion. And that's a projective mapping. It's a way of mappings that is very interesting. And the nice thing is that it can be simply described by a little matrix. So the entire process, mapping a point from 3D space into our image, including depth, can be stored by 16 values. And by only a few multiplications and additions, we can compute that. OK, good. So now we mapped all these triangles into image space. And then we have to rasterize them. I already showed that. Yeah, we have to, for a triangle in screen space, now on the left, this is the triangle in screen space. The little squares are the pixels. And now we have to find out which pixels intersect the triangle or for which pixels is the midpoint within the triangle. That's the typical definition. Yeah, and then we get the image on the right. And of course, in this resolution, it looks very jaggy. But with high-resolution displays today, this gives you a really nice representation of that triangle. There are variants for rasterization that only compute lines or line connections, rasterized lines, and maybe also circle arcs and stuff like that. We will also speak shortly about that. But this filling rasterization here is the most important part. OK, then, as I said, we also have to compute or want to compute visibility. So if we have a rasterized image, like on the left, this is quite simple. Yeah, I mean, the obvious solution is that for every pixel, we store the depth, how far that point visible through that pixel is away from the camera. And when a new point for that pixel comes in, we just compare the depth. Yeah? And if the new point is further away, it's obviously occluded. And if the new point is closer, then we override. Yeah? So that's a very, very simple and very efficient solution. The point, or the difficult part, we need a reasonable depth. We will see that, how we can get this. A more difficult variant of occlusion is what we see here on the lower right. Because if we only render the outlines of the triangles or of the polygons, which makes perfect sense for technical drawings like the one in the lower right, then this occlusion trick won't work. Yeah, because this wireframe model you can just see through. So removing lines, as we see here in the lower right, is not a very simple problem. But this is not what we will speak about. Yeah, it's kind of, as soon as triangles are filled, it's much easier. OK, and in the very end, now we have all these triangles, all these pixels on the screen. And now we need for each of these pixels a color. And as I said before, we do not set the pixel just to the color of the object. Yeah, so that everything is plain red or whatever. We also want to have a shading on it. That means that the color should vary together with the orientation of the surface, respecting also the positions of light sources and stuff like that. And there are two things that we have to consider. The first one is the reflection. So how does the surface reflect incoming light? Yeah? So here you see, it's just a random picture from one of many, many papers on that topic. How can we describe this reflection? There are a number of physical approaches to describe that, but there's often also just heuristics to make that usable, and that has much less parameters. So we will see how this reflection can be described. And the second part is that we have to find out for the objects that we see how what is the incident light. And the simplest way is that we say, okay, we have a light source, and now we directly connect the point that we see with the light source. Yeah, and we say, okay, we the simple physics, how much light emitted from here arrives here. And that's very simple to compute. That's what we call a local lighting model. But there are much more complicated models where light from the light sources can bounce multiple times before it hits that point. Yeah? And that means now there's not only a direct connection from the light source to this point, but it can arrive from multiple directions via many bounces in between. This gives a very special, much smoother, and much more realistic look, but it's also much, much, much more complicated to compute. I showed you last on Tuesday several images with that one atrium that took something like 17 hours to compute. That's an example for a global illumination method. In interactive graphics, you typically use local models that are much, much faster to compute. Okay, and if we bring all this together, we have here the very, very first coarse and two coarse version of our rendering pipeline. So we have a 3D object on the left. This consists of a number of triangles in world space. Then we transform these, so that's much geometry, much math, linear algebra. Then we get triangles in screen space. Then we rasterize them. Then we get a number of pixels. And on these pixels, we compute lighting. So we get pixels with color. And these we write on the screen. Yeah? So that's a very, very first and coarse way to describe the pipeline. In fact, each of these stages consists of several substages. And we will see that when we dive into these parts. And in order to make the programming lectures and maybe also the lecture itself more interesting, the first thing we start to look to have a closer look at is the lighting here in the end. The advantage is that in the programming lectures, you will see that it's quite easy to write interesting lighting models, and that you immediately get visual feedback, yeah, how your new model changes the look of an object that you see on the screen. So we will start with that part and then work from back to front through that pipeline and look at these different stages of the pipeline. Okay, and I have 2 minutes left, but I think it doesn't make sense to start with lighting. So we will do that next week, and we will see again on Tuesday. Thank you.